Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside.
Episode SP17B, Spring Holiday Special 2010, Part 2.
Hello and welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Ruth.
And I'm Gary. This is the second half of our Spring Holiday Special for 2010. And before we crack on with what promises to be a monster show, we'd just like to let you know that you can contact us in lots of ways. By sending an email to Gary and Ruth at CelticMythPodShow.com, or using our answering machine on Skype, which is free, or loads of other ways that can be found on the How to Contact Us page on the website.
And we've got some other news about changes on the website.
Excellent. So should we have those in news and views?
Yes, let's. So what's new on the website then?
Well, the first thing is that I've added a confused start here page, which may be the wrong name for it. So if anyone's got any better ideas, let me know. The idea is that it's a kind of site overview, so you can see what we've got on the site. And I'm also marking those things that are new and updated.
Oh, I see. So it's a quick way to see what's worth having a quick look at. How long will you keep the new and updated graphics there, then?
About a week, I reckon.
Okay.
So, you know, we mentioned in the last show we got the Skype answer phone thingy working.
Yes.
Well, the main thing about that is that it's free, which I think is brilliant. The telephone recorder thing that we had... They still charge you the cost of a local call, whatever country you're in.
Hmm.
So you set yourself up a Skype account, you can leave us a message for nout, as they say.
So you mean nothing or free, don't you?
Yes.
Also, many of you asked if you could make donations to the show to help with expenses. And after much thought, we've agreed to gratefully accept your gifts. And Gary's put a donate button on the front page of our website.
Yes. We just thought we'd have to wait until we saved up enough to fix broken equipment. But your offers of help are so kind, we can't ignore them. And we've just had to bow our heads and say thank you to you for all of your support.
And your donations are very welcome.
Thank you. We'd also like to thank Colleen and James for their help so far. You guys are stars.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else new on the site?
Oh, yes. We've been nominated for the European Podcast Awards for 2010 in the non-profit category. We're so proud.
That's so cool. I noticed the button on our front page.
Yes.
And we've put a couple of links on our Facebook fan page as well, so you'll be able to find the links there as well.
That's great. And they allow you to vote every day. So if anyone else wants to vote, that would be great too.
Yes, thanks. Is there anything else, or can we get on with this wonderful show?
The show. Oh, okay. The show. Yes.
The show.
Yes, we've got the second part of our Scottish story, The Wife or the Wuddy, a wonderful section from a superb book about the gods that you can find in the British Isles, a poem from a listener, and four great pieces of music.
So shall we start with some music?
Yes. Yes, we've got a lovely piece of fiddle music, specially arranged by a good friend across the pond, Samantha Gilligley, of an old Christmas ballad, To Drive the Cold Winter Away.
She tells us she loves the first verse, so we've added that to her wonderful piece for you. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
hail to the days that merit more praise than all the rest of the year. And welcome the nights that double delights for both the poor and the peer. Sweet blessings attend each merry man's friend, each does but the best that he may, forgetting all wrongs with poems and songs to drive the cold winter away.
That was beautiful, Sam. Thank you so much.
You can find this track on her Winter Solstice EP, and more details are in the show notes.
Now, we're really privileged to bring you a small section from a wonderful book written by David Rankin and Sarita Deste called The Isles of Many Gods.
The book is an absolutely brilliant reference work, and it covers the gods that can be found in the British Isles from the first millennium CE through to the Middle Ages. The Origins of the Gods by David Rankin and Sarita Deste.
Through the first millennium CE until the Middle Ages, a wide range of gods and goddesses were worshipped in the British Isles. Some of these were local gods, some of these were brought to these islands by the many waves of invaders, conquerors and travellers throughout the centuries. It is also likely that there were many more deities than those recorded in this book, for which evidence of their existence is lacking or is currently inconclusive. The British Isles became home to the peoples, practices, and gods of many different cultures during its history. And through the merging of old and new, it is clear that Britain has long been a spiritual centre in which diversity was accepted. Let us now consider the origins of the gods and goddesses who played a role in the shaping of the landscape and culture of Britain.
From the 8th century BCE onwards, tribes from Europe were travelling to Britain and settling, often intermarrying with the indigenous tribes. These tribes are sometimes referred to as Celtic, and this emigration may have resulted in the introduction of gods from Europe. Later waves of European tribes, such as the Belgae from Gaul, probably brought some of their Gallic gods with them, resulting in the introduction of non-indigenous gods who were already being worshipped in Britain when the Romans invaded. The people in Britain prior to the Roman invasion did not build in stone and had an oral culture. The result of this is that very little evidence of indigenous gods from pre-Roman times has survived, and never with associated names to enable identification. What is clear is that these deities were usually local deities, worshipped by individual tribes in the area where they lived, and sometimes associated with particular places because of landscape features such as rivers and wells or springs. Where there is no obvious parallel in Europe, we can conjecture that deities may have been native rather than being introduced from Europe, though this is almost impossible to prove either way. The gods we are defining with the label indigenous are those whose names were first recorded by the Romans in inscriptions on altars and statues, for whom the earliest evidence is found in Britain. These are gods who were worshipped in Britain before the Roman invasion of 43 CE. And because the indigenous tribes were oral cultures, the names of these deities were Latinized by the Romans who recorded them, so we cannot even be sure that their names are accurate survivals of those they were worshipped by. This translation of oral native cultures into the literary Roman culture resulted in variations in the recording of names, even within localized areas. And thus we see, for example, 15 different variant spellings of the name of the god Vitiris on the 40 Roman altars with his name on that have been discovered in northern England and Scotland.
The word Celt has been incredibly misused and abused. It's derived from the ancient Greek word Keltoi, meaning barbarian or uncivilized. It first appears in the writing of the Greek historian Hecataeus in 517 BCE when he referred to a Germanic tribe. The Greek historian Herodotus, in his Histories 431 to 425 BCE, also referred to the Keltoi with regard to the Germanic tribes. The Romans used the Latinized version of this term, Celts, applying it to the tribes of Gaul and surrounding areas. Celtic as a term is now usually accepted as representing a large group of European tribes starting from around 1200 BCE. Initially, these tribes were centered on Hallstatt in Austria and are known as the Hallstatt culture. From the Late Bronze Age through to the Iron Age, during the time period 1200 to 475 BCE, these tribes expanded and their territories extended east as far as Croatia, Slovenia, Slovakia and western Hungary, and west and south to western France, southern Germany, Bohemia, northern Italy and Switzerland. A second phase in the development of the Celtic tribes was the Latin culture, named after the place in Switzerland where evidence was first discovered. The Latin period was from 500 to 15 BCE and seems to have had a greater military focus than the previous Hallstatt culture. The Latin tribes were originally found between eastern France and Bohemia. However, they expanded rapidly, settling in Spain around 450 BCE and northern Italy around 400 BCE. They also invaded and pillaged various other cultures successfully, including Rome in 390 BCE and Greece in 279 BCE. By 200 BCE, they'd spread through France, Germany, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland and Britain. And you can hear the second half of this great piece from their book Isles of Many Gods after the story. But first, let's listen to the beautiful sounds of Jenna Green and Believe.
What an adventure we've had, my friend. But even fairy balls must have an end. As you recount the dances in your head, I'll tuck you safely in your bed. I must fly, though I won't be far. Just wish on mushroom, stone or star. Fairies roam, but never leave. If in your heart you believe, fairy queens, when you believe, my darling girl, you bring fairy magic back to your world. When you wake up, though it may seem that fairy light a dream, remember past. and crystal streams, and the great hall of the fairy queen. When doubters say we don't exist, tell them by pixies you've been kissed. Trust though others cannot perceive, blessings abound when fairy queens, when you believe, my darling girl, you bring fairy magic back to your world. Dear child, don't grow too fast, make childhood moments and last. Treasure each flower, cherish each day, remember to laugh your cares away, keep your wonder and wild heart, and from the
Jenna Green before, and we're really pleased to be able to bring you this song from her album Crossroads called Believe.
Jenna tells us that I wrote this song for my daughter and all children at heart. It's about a magical friendship between a fairy and a human child. The fairy teaches the child to always believe in herself and in her dreams. This song has become my personal anthem. I end every concert with Believe to remind myself and my audience that believing is the magic that creates reality.
Great, superb, isn't it?
That's spot on, isn't it?
You can find out much more about Green Lady Music in our show notes and on her contributor page on the website.
Brilliant. So, are you ready for the second part of our Scottish Borders tale, The Wife or the Wuddy?
Oh yes, it's about time. We're all waiting with bated breath. And it's about time. I thought we were never going to get round to it.
Of course we are. Okay. The Wife or the Wuddy by John McKay Wilson. Part 2. It was early on the following morning that Micklemouthed Meg, as she was called, requested an interview with her father, which, being granted, after respectfully rendering obeisance before him, she said,
"So, Feather, I understand it's your pleasure that I shall this day become the wife of a young Scott o' Harden." "I think, sir, that is due to the daughter of Mori or Elibank, that she should be courted before she gives her hand. The young man has never seen me. He kens nothing concerning me. And ne'er would your daughter disgrace ye by giving her hand to a man who only accepted it to save his neck from a hempen cord. Father, if it be your command that I am to marry him, I will and must marry him. But before I just make a venture upon him for better for worse, and for life, I would like to have some acquaintance with him, to see what sort of lad he is, and what kind of temper he has. And therefore, father, I humbly crave that ye will put off the death or marriage for a week at least, that I may have the opportunity of judging him for myself, how far it would be prudent or becoming in me to consent to be his wife.
Give me your hand, Meg. I didn't think he had as much spirit and gumption in ye as to say what he has said. Your request is useless. Three has already point blank refused to hear ye. And there is nothing left for him but before sunset to strike his heels against the bark of the old elm tree.
Say not that, father. Let me at least have 4 days to become acquainted with him. And if in that time he does not make a request to you to marry me without any dowry, then will I say that I look even worse than I get the name of doing.
Aye, he shall have 4 days, Meg. For your sake he'll have him. But if at the end of 4 days he shall refuse to take ye, he shall hang afore this window, and his poor half-crazed companion shall bear him company.
With this assurance, Agnes, or as she was called, Meg, left her father, and bethought her of how she might save the prisoners and secure a husband. The mother of the laird sat in the midst of her daughters, mourning for him, and looking from the window of the tower, as though in every form that appeared in the distance she expected to see him, or at least to gather tidings regarding him, when information was brought to her that he was the prisoner of Murray of Elibank.
Then the days on my winsome way are numbered, and his death is determined on. For often has Sir Gideon declared he would give the lands of Elibank for his head. My Willie is my only son, my firstborn, my heart's hope and treasure. And oh, if I lose him now, I shall ne'er again hear his friendly voice say, Mother, nor stroke down his yellow hair. With him that has made me sonless, I shall have a day, a long day of fearful reckoning. Cold shall be the hearthstone in the house of many a Murray, and loud shall be their lamentation.
Her daughters wept with her for their brother's fate, but they didn't know how to comfort her. And while they sat mingling their tears together, it was announced to them that a humble maiden bearing a message from the captive laird desired to speak with her.
Show her in. Take me to her. Where is she? What does she say? Well, what does my Willie say?
And the maiden, who has been mentioned as having visited the laird in his prison, was ushered into her presence.
Come to me, lassie. Come and tell me, what a message does Willie Scott send to his heartbroken mother?
He sent you this bit packet, ma'am. I should be right glad to take back whatever your answer you may have to send.
And what are you, young woman, that speaks so kindly to a mother and takes an interest in the fate of my Willie?
A despised lassie, but then that would risk her own life to save either yours or his.
Bless you for the words,
replied Lady Scott, as she broke the seal of her son's letter and read.
My mother, my honoured mother, fate has delivered me into the power of Maria Elibank, the enemy of our house. He's doomed me to death, and I die tomorrow. But sit not down to mourn for me, and uselessly wring the hands and tear the hair, but rouse every Scot upon the borders to rise up and be my avenger. If ye bewail the loss of a son, let them spare the Murrays neither son nor daughter. Arouse ye, let a mother's vengeance nerve your arm. Poor Simon O'Yarrowfoot is to be my companion in death, and he whines to meet his fate with the weakness of a woman, and yearns a perpetual yearning for his wife and bairns. Oh, on that account I forgive him the want of heart and determination which he manifests, But see ye to them. Take care that they be provided for. As for me, I should meet me doom wi disdain for my enemy in my eyes and on my tongue. And even in death he shall feel that I despise him. And the proof of this I have given him already, for he has offered to save my life, providing I would marry his daughter, Micklemouth Meg. But I have scorned his proposal.
You are right, Willie, you are right, lad,
exclaimed his mother, while the letter shook in her hand. But suddenly, bursting into tears, she continued,
No, no, my bairn was wrong, very wrong. Life is precious, and all times desirable. And for his poor mother's sake, he'd ought to have married the lassie, whatever she may be like.
And turning to the bearer of the letter, she inquired,
And what like may the lady be, the marrying of whom could save my Willie's life?
You have no doubt heard, my lady, that she is not what the world considers it to be a likely lass. So take her as she is, and you might find a handle worse wives than poor Meg would make. And as for her features, I may say that she looks much the same as I do. And if she doesn't appear better, she at least doesn't look any worse.
Then if she be as ye say, and look as ye say, my poor headstrong Willie ought to marry her. But oh, well do I ken that everything he is just as his father are again. And yet I might as well think of moving the Erin Hills as force him to do anything.
She perused the concluding part of her son's letter, in which he spoke enthusiastically of the kindness shown him by the fair messenger, and of the promise she had made to liberate him if possible.
And if she does, whatever be her parentage, on the day that I should be free, she should be my wife. I would have preferred death to the hand of Sir Gideon's comely daughter.
Lassie, my poor really speaks a deal of kindness you have shown him in honour of his distress, and for that kindness his mother's heart thanks ye. But do you not think that it is possible that I could accompany you to Elibank? And if you can devise no means for him to escape, perhaps you should get me admitted into his presence. When he saw his poor distressed mother upon her knees before him, his heart would soften, and he would marry Sir Gideon's daughter, ill-featured though she may be.
Well, lady, it is little that I can promise, and less that I can do. But if you desire to see your son, I think I could answer for accomplishing your request. And though nae good might come of it, I could also say that I would see you safe back again.
Within an hour, Lady Scott, disguised as a peasant and carrying a basket on her arm, set out for Elibank, accompanied by the fair stranger. Leaving them upon their melancholy journey, we shall return to the young laird. From the windows of his prison house, he beheld the sunrise which was to be the last on which he was to look. He heard the sentinels who kept watch over him relieve each other. He heard them pacing to and fro before the grated door. And as the sun rose towards the south, proclaiming the approach of noon, the agitation of Simon increased. He sat in the corner of the prison and strove to pray. And as the footsteps of the sentinels quickened, he groaned in the bitterness of his spirit. At length, the loud booming of the gong announced that the dial plate upon the turret marked the hour of 12. Simon clasped his hands together.
Maester, maester, our hour is come, and one word from your lips could save us both, and you winna speak it. The very holding of your hand could do it. But you're stubborn even unto death.
Simon, I left it as an injunction upon my mother that your wife and wains be provided for, and she'll fulfil my request. Oh, therefore be ye content. Die like a man. Dinna disgrace both yourself and me.
Oh, sir, I winna disgrace, or in any manner dishonour ye. And I do not see the smallest necessity for us to die, and especially when both our lives could be saved by your doing yourself a good turn.
And while he spoke, the sound of the sentinel's footsteps pacing to and fro ceased. A prison door was opened. Simon fell upon his knees. The young laird looked towards the intruding guard proudly.
Your lives are spared for another day, that the Laird Harden may have time to reflect upon the proposal that has been made to him. But let him not hope that he will find mercy upon other terms. or that refusing them for another day his life will be prolonged.
The door was again closed, and the bolts were drawn. The spirit of Sir Gideon was too proud and impatient to spare the lives of his prisoners for 4 days, as he had promised to his daughter to do, and he now resolved that they should die upon the following day. The sun had again set, and the dim lamp shed around its fitful and shadowy lights from the table of the prison room, when the maiden, who had carried the letter to the laird's mother, again entered.
"Ah, this is kind, very kind, gentle maiden. Would that I could reward you. And who fares it with my poor mother? What answer does she send?"
"And, oh, madam, or mistress, who fares it with me dear wife and bairns? I hope you told them that I desired you to see. And who did she bear the news of being made a widow? And what did she say to my injunction that she was never to marry again?"
"You talk wildly, man. But wasn't it in my power to carry your commands to your wife? But I trust it will be longer than you expect before she will be a widow. Or how in that power to marry again?"
"Oh, ye angel, ye perfect picture. Oh, what is that which I hear you say? Do you mean to tell me that I stand a chance of being saved and that I should see me wife and bairns again?"
"Even so, but whether you do or do not, rest with your master."
"Speak not of that, sweet maiden. But tell me, what says my mother? How does she bear the fate of her son? And who does she promise to avenge me death?"
"She is one whose heartstrings are torn asunder, and she refuses to be comforted. And she would rather have another daughter than lose her only son. And her prayer is that you will live and make her happy by marrying the maiden you despise."
"What? What? Has even my mother so far forgot herself as to desire me to marry the daughter of her enemy, whom no other man could be found to take? Och, it shall ne'er be. I would abear in anything but that."
"But I still think you're wrong to reject and despise poor Meg before ye have even seen her. She may both be better and look better than ye are aware of. There are as good as Scott of Harden, who has said that were it in their power, they would make her their wife. And ye should remember, sir, that it will be as pleasant for you to hear the blithe Levelock singing over your head as for another person to hear the wind soughing and the long grass rustling over your grave. Ye have another day to live and see her and speak to her before you decide rashly. Yours is a cruel doom, but Sir Gideon is a wrathful man, and even for his own flesh and blood, he has but small compassion when his anger is provoked. Death, too, is an awful thing to think about. And therefore, for your own sake, and for the sake of your poor, distressed mother and sisters, dinna come to a rash determination."
"Sweet lass, I respect the sympathy which ye evince, but never shall Sir Gideon Murray say that in order to save my life he terrified me into a marriage with his daughter. And when my poor mother's grief has subsided, she will think differently on my decision."
"Well, sir, since you will not listen to my advice, and I own that I have no right to offer it, I will send in one to you whose persuasion may have more avail."
"He merely send? It isn't possible that ye can have been playing me false."
"No, that isn't possible. And for her that I will send to you, you will see whether or not I have kept my word, good and truly, to fulfill your message."
And so saying, she withdrew, leaving him much wondering at her words, and yet more at the interest which she took in his fate. But she had not long withdrawn when the prison door was again open, and Lady Scott rushed into the arms of her son.
My mother, how is this?"
"Oh, joy and gladness, and every blessing be upon my honoured lady. Oh, for new any stand some chance of walking back upon my own feet to see my family. Oh, your ladyship, join your prayers to my prayer, and try if you can persuade my mercer to marry Sir Gideon's daughter, and thereby save both his life and mine."
But she fell upon the neck of her son, and seemed not to hear the words which Simon addressed to her.
"Oh, my son, since there is no other way which by your life can be ransomed, yield to the demand of the fierce Murray. Marry his daughter and live. Save your wretched mother's life, for your death, Willie, would be mine also."
"Mother, I would never accept life upon such terms. I'm in Mary's hands, but the day may come. Yea, see ye that it does come, when he shall fall into the hands of the Scots of Harden. And see ye that ye do to him as he shall have done to me. But tell me, Mather, how are ye here? Wherefore did ye venture? How ye get permission to see me? Ken ye not that if he found ye in his power, upon your life also he would fix a ransom?
The kind lassie that brought the letter from ye, at my request conducted me here, and she contrived to get me permission to see ye. And she says that my visit shall not come to the knowledge of Sir Gideon. But, oh, Willie, as you love and respect the mother that bore you, and that nursed you at night and day at her bosom, do not throw away your life when it's in your power to save it. But marry Miss Murray, and ye may live, and so may I, to see many happy days. For from all that I heard, though not well favoured, she is a young lady of excellent disposition.
Oh, that's right, my lady. Urge him to marry her, for it would be a dreadful thing for him and I to be gibbeted as a pair of perpetual spectacles for the Murrays to make a jester. You can, if he does marry, and if he finds he doesn't like her, he can leave her. Or if he needn't lay with her, perhaps she may soon die, and she will certainly agree that marriage, only way you take it, is to be desired a thousand times over before a violent death. And therefore, urge him again, your ladyship, for he may listen to what you say, though he despises my words and will not hearken to my advice.
Simon, never shall a Murray hae it in his power to boast that he struck terror into the breast of a Scot of Harden. My determination is as fixed as fate. I shall welcome my doom and meet it as a man. Come, dear Mather, weep not, nor cause me to appear in the presence of my enemies with a blanched cheek. Hasten to avenge my death, and think that in your revenge your son lives again. Come, though I die, there will be moonlight again.
She hung upon his breast and wept, but he turned away his head and refused to listen to her entreaties. The young maiden again entered the prison and said,
"You must part now, for in a few minutes Sir Gideon will be astir, and should he find your ladyship here, or discover that I have brought you, I would have small power to give you protection."
"Farewell, dear Mel, farewell,"
exclaimed the youth, grasping her hand.
Oh, Willie, did I bear you to see you come to an end like this? Pardon, Bell, live for your mother's sake, live."
"Farewell, mother, farewell,"
he again cried, and the sentinel conducted her from the apartment. It again drew towards noon. The loud gong again sounded, and Simon sank upon his knees in despair as the voice of the warder was heard crying,
"It is you, prepare the prisoners for execution."
Again the prison door was opened, and Sir Gideon, with wrath upon his brow, stood before them.
"Well, youngster, your hour is come. What is your choice? A wife or the widow?"
"Leave me to execution, you old knave. And ken that with a hemp around my neck, in contempt of you and yours, I'll spit upon the ground where you tread."
"Here, guards, lead forth William Scott of Harden to execution. Strap him upon the nearest tree, and there let him hang until the boldest Scot upon the borders dare to cut him down. As you, Simon, I seek not your life. Depart ye free. Beware how ye again fall into the hands of Gideon Murray."
"No, sir, though I am free to acknowledge that I hae nae ambition to die before it is the wise will and purpose of nature, and yet I winna, I canna leave my dear young maister. And if he be to suffer, I'll share his fate. Only, Sid Gideon, there's ae thing I hae to say, and that is that he is a young, and he is prude and stubborn, like yourself, and though he will not of his ain free will and accord, nor in obedience yet to your commandments marry a daughter, is it not possible to compel him, whether he be willing or no, so save his life, as it were, in spite of him?"
"Away we both,"
cried the knight, striking his iron heel upon the ground and leaving the apartment.
"Oh, then if it is to be, it must be,"
said Simon, folding his arms in resignation.
"And there is nae help for it. Oh, maester, ye acted foolishly."
They were led from the prison house and through the courtyard towards a tall elm tree, around which all the retainers of Sir Gideon were assembled to witness the execution. And the old knight took his place upon an elevated seat in the midst of them. The executioners were preparing to perform their office, and when Agnes, or Mucklemouthed Meg as she was called, came forth, with a deep veil thrown over her face, and sinking on her knee before the old knight, said imploringly,
"A boon, dear fellow. Your daughter begs a simple boon."
"Oh, you take an ill season to ask it, Meg. But what may it be?"
She whispered to him earnestly for a few minutes, during which his countenance exhibited indignation and surprise. And when she'd finished speaking, she again knelt before him and embraced his knees.
"Rise, Meg, rise. For your sake and at your request, he shall have another chance to live."
And approaching the prisoner, he added,
"William Scott, ye have chosen death in preference to the hand of my daughter. Will you now prefer to die rather than marry the lassie that ran with a letter to your mother, and without my consent brought her to see ye?"
"Had another asked me the question, though I ken not who she is, yet she has a kind heart, and I should have said no, and offered her my hand, heart, and fortune. But you," said Gideon, "I only say, do your worst."
"Then, Willie, my own Willie,"
cried his mother, who at that moment rushed forward.
"Another does request you, Marion. And that is your own mother,
said Agnes, stepping forward and throwing aside the veil that covered her face.
"Poor Meg, or who ye gear a preference to the gallows, also requests thee."
"What?"
exclaimed the young laird, grasping her hand.
"Is the kind lassie that has striven night and day to save me the very Meg that I have been treating with disdain?"
"In troth I am. Do ye prefer the wordy still?"
"No. Sir Gideon, I am now willing that the ceremony end in matrimony."
"Be it so,"
said the old knight, and the spectators burst into a shout. The day that began with preparations for death ended in a joyful bridal. The honour of knighthood was afterwards conferred upon the laird, and Meg bore unto him many sons and daughters, and was, as our listeners will be ready to believe, one of the best wives in Scotland. While Simon declared that he never saw a better-looking woman in Ettrick Forest, his own wife and daughters not excepted.
That's really nice.
It's great, isn't it? I was moist in the gills at the end there.
Oh, dear.
Mr. Wilson collected a vast number of stories from the borders in his life, and you'll find a link to Volume 2 on Project Gutenberg, which is where this story came from, in the show notes.
Now, we started part two of this spring holiday special with a harken back to winter. So now let's look forward to the new growth of spring and the energy of new life with a wonderful poem, or Calling to the Great God, the Dagda, written by a show listener, Andy Hinkinson Hodnett, who retains the copyright to this work.
Dagda by Andy Hinkinson Hodnett. My father is your father, everybody's father. The father of us all. The father of Breid, or Bride, or Bridget. A good god, Dagda. The red god. The phallic god. His cauldron is never dry. His flame is eternal. Fire in the belly and the loins. Fire in the eye. Fertile lover of the great queen, the lord of perfect knowledge, play your harp of seasons change,
Swing your club that slays and revives. Strong Dugda, hungry Dugda, lustful Dugda, merciful Dugda. Hear us, old giant, druid of oak and hazel, compassionate and just, eldest, wisest, mightiest one. Bring your wisdom and lust for life, passion in all things, for all things, victory to those who fight for the right, and join us in our circle of love.
Beautiful, Andy. Thank you for allowing us to read it.
It was. And the Dugda is such a powerful force of the spring.
He certainly is.
The ancient Celts called him the Allfather in respect of this fertility aspect, which just shows how much they thought of him in the Wheel of the Year. We've got some wonderful springtime music from Dave the Bard in a moment. But first, let's let David Rankin and Sarita Deste tell us more about the gods of the British Isles in part two of our reading from their book, The Isles of Many Gods. Although there were many areas of commonality, each tribe also had unique practices, and this is also reflected in their deities. Many Celtic gods and goddesses were localized deities, often tutelary gods of tribes, with links to the sacred landscape, particularly water features. Prior to the Roman influence, the Celts did not have the same tendency to anthropomorphize their gods, and this is probably why the evidence for some of the deities is confined to Romano-Celtic dedicatory inscriptions. Indeed, when the Celts overran the shrine at Delphi in 279 BCE, the Celtic leader Brennus laughed at the Greek anthropomorphic images of their gods. The Celts seem to have associated their deities very strongly with nature through the landscape and the animals which inhabited it. A result of this is the importance attached to cult animals attributed to particular deities, such as the bear, boar, bull, horse, raven, and serpent. The Celts did not worship in buildings in the manner of the classical cultures, preferring to work within the landscape, in sacred groves and at sacred waterways. The animistic worldview may also be why many of the representations that do exist of the Celtic gods are simple and roughly hewn carvings in stone, as it would have been easy for artisans as skilled as the Celts to produce much finer images if they chose to. When the Romans invaded Britain in 43 CE, they brought with them a whole host of gods from conquered cultures, who had been absorbed into the religious spectrum of the Roman Empire. Information about these gods has been recorded in far more detail in Roman writings, and the worship of these gods goes back to the founding of Rome, or earlier. The information provided in this work looks specifically at the evidence for their worship in the British Isles, and does not explore the wealth of information about the deities to be found in Roman writings, a task which would require many volumes to do.
What is necessary is to explore the way some of these gods came to be worshipped by the Romans and brought with them to Britain to further their influence. A whole host of gods from conquered cultures, including the Egyptians, Greeks, Persians, Syrians, and Phoenicians, were absorbed into the religious spectrum of the Roman Empire. Of these gods, the most evidence of worship found in Britain is for the Greco-Egyptian gods. When the Romans took over Egypt from the Greeks, they continued the process of integrating the local gods into their own system of deities. The Romans, with their love of Greek culture, adopted the Greco-Egyptian deities, and many of these deities gained popularity in Rome and throughout the Roman Empire. The Roman technique of incorporating warriors from conquered tribes into their army and then sending them to another part of the empire resulted in other deities being brought to Britain with those warriors. Notably, this included deities from Gaul, France, and what is now Belgium and Germany, such as Epona, Nantoswelta, and Sikelos, Gubanus, the Elisagae, and others.
In 410 CE, as the Roman Empire fell apart, the Romans pulled the last of their troops out of Britain. The Romans had already been contending with marauding tribes of Angles, Jutes, and Saxons from Germany for over a century. The remaining British tribes held off the bulk of the Saxons and other tribes until around 450 CE, when they started settling in southern England. The main influx of Saxons was from around 500 CE, though the Battle of Mount Badon in 496 CE staved the Saxon expansion through England for about 50 years. The gods worshipped by these tribes were versions of those that were worshipped by the Scandinavian Norse culture, with the same qualities and legends being mainly distinguished by variations in name. And thus we see, for example, Woden instead of Odin, Thunor instead of Thor. Nevertheless, their qualities are largely the same, and they played a major role in daily life as protection and providers of good weather and crops, to be propitiated and appealed to for help. Like the Celts, the Saxons had a very animistic and vital spiritual and religious worldview. It was heavily populated with non-human creatures, like elves and other spirits. As with the Celts, there is much less recorded documentation of the Saxon spiritual practices, and what there is must be viewed through the Christian filter of those who recorded it. That the Saxon gods were a significant part of British religious development cannot be doubted, as evidenced by the traces they'd left behind in the names of the days of the week, from Tuesday to Friday, and in many place names across England. As with the Saxons themselves, their deities became firmly a part of the British Isles.
The return of the pagan gods. After nearly 1,000 years of Christianity, the 19th century saw a revival of interest in the old gods. This has been subtly increasing for the previous 2 centuries in Britain and can be seen in literary references, such as those found in the works of Shakespeare or allegorical works using pagan imagery, such as Spenser's Faerie Queen, through to authors such as Byron, Keats, Shelley and Wordsworth. From the beginning of the 18th century, there was a revival of interest in Druidry. From early attempts at reconstruction, these groups seem to have been largely Christian, until the mid-20th century, with the introduction of much more Celtic imagery and symbolism, resulting in a whole plethora of Druid groups both Christian and pagan. The 18th century also saw the gradual British colonisation of India. From this, a slow trickle of Hindu ideas, which began to blossom in the late 19th century through such organisations as the Theosophical Society, resulted in the inclusion of a whole range of Indian concepts into modern paganism, such as karma and chakras.
Since the 1950s, with large numbers of people arriving from the Commonwealth, followed by more recent tides from the European Union, Britain has become an increasingly multicultural society. As a result, the number of deities from around the world worshipped in Britain is nigh on impossible to determine, and indeed can even be described as a global pantheon of worship. The development of subsequent traditions like Wicca and its neo-pagan offshoots is well documented, and needs no further comment, except to say that the old pagan gods are more in our midst than they have been for many centuries.
Now let's have some more wonderful music from our long-term supporter and almost resident bard, Dave the Bard, and welcome in the spring with his wonderful track, The Greenwood Grove.
Oh yes.
Thank you.
torch of the new beginning. The Rowan Star with magic guarding, all the sight the future showing. The sweet willow sees her moon rising. Ash three realms he is touching. Hawthorne tells us the May is coming. Mighty oak with strength is standing. The holly on his chariot riding. Come follow me, come dance with me. Come with me to the greenwood grove, such magic there to see. The Lord of the Wild with his fairy kin, deep within the greenwood grove, we'll dance the magic ring. Wise Hazel watches the salmon feeding. Is ripe, intoxicating. I am the ivy, heed my warning. Yellow broom I offer healing. Blackthorn sharp for death preparing. The elder is a life of learning. Further distant future showing. Come follow me, come dance with me. Come with me to the greenwood grove, such magic there to see. The Lord of the Wild with his fairy kin, deep within the greenwood grove, we'll dance the magic ring. I am destroying. Hither from day three creating. Hear the aspen's leaves are whispering. That you is death and life returning. Come follow me, come dance with me. Come with me to the greenwood groves of magic there to see. The Lord of the Wild with his fairy kin, deep within the greenwood grove, we'll dance the magic ring.
I love that song.
Yes, I do too. You'll find it on the Hills They Are Hollow album, as well as more information about Dave and his work and his music in the show notes.
Do you think now's the time to let the surprise out?
Oh, for goodness sake, yes, go on then.
Yay! Right, okay then. Well, our next episode is going to be an amazing interview with Dave and his partner, the artist Kerry Lee, in which they talk about his music, her art, and the effect that Druidry has on them both.
Definitely not one to be missed, folks. I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. And now we'd normally have some listener feedback, but we've got so many lovely things to bring to you that we thought what we'd do is create a special feedback show.
Yes. While I'm not too well, a show like that is a lot easier to make. So it helps us keep in touch with you guys rather than us disappearing off the face of the planet.
Brilliant. But we can slip a quick promo in, though, can't we?
Oh, yes. Do you remember the great Fae story that Philippa Ballantyne brought us in podcast and later book form called Chasing the Bard?
Yes, I do. The world of Fae mixing with the Shakespeare's Elizabethan world.
Yes, that's right. Well, Pip is bringing us the sequel to that novel in a new podcast called Digital Magic, which brings us right up to modern times. Have a listen to the promo.
The Fae world is lost. We have spun beyond the reach of the human world. But some chose to stay. Lost, magical souls adrift in a world of the future. And yet now, as the darkness approaches, you must rely on the orphans we left behind to save your world. Step back into the world of magic and find out what happens when the future and the Fae collide. Digital Magic, sequel to the award-winning Chasing the Bard, begins on November 11th, 2009. Subscribe at digitalmagicnovel.com and prepare for magic.
Ooh, that sounds exciting.
She's got about half a dozen episodes available now and a lot on her plate at the moment, so we hope she manages to get them out. She is, I believe, stepping into writing as a full-time career. So we both wish you good luck, Pip.
Absolutely. Good luck with everything and keep us in touch with how you're doing, Pip.
And now, to finish off the show with a bang and really see spring in with a resounding roll of thunder. Was that a bit over the top, do you think?
No, I thought it was quite appropriate, really.
So see what you think with the amazing sound of the pentacle drummers.
Yes, the drummers follow in a long line of English traditions that started with mumming and Morris, and now has many other thriving branches, such as border Morris and drumming groups.
And they're incredibly rousing to see live.
They certainly are.
Yeah, we've actually got a video on our YouTube page to give you an idea. But you can really get a feel with their track, Nines.
Wow, you can really feel your blood pounding after that, can't you?
You can. Spring is here, guys.
It definitely is.
Let's dance.
Okay, well, I think you'd better slow up before you do yourself a mischief.
All right, then. All
no
right.
Dancing, all right? Let somebody else do that for you.
Yeah, I can watch.
That track was from their album Life in Tatters, and you can find more details in the show notes. We better wish all our wonderful friends goodbye, and we'll see you in the next show.
True, true. So with many, many blessings, we'd like to say...
Slongavoil!
The animistic worldview may also be why many loathe representations. I wonder what that means. Maybe it's of. The animistic...
loathe the representations approach.
Funny, oh funny. So let's look forward to the new growth of Spryn. Should I just give up?
He heard the sentinels who kept watch over him relieve each other. Better than relieving themselves, I suppose.
So where I was. That's interesting prison, don't we?
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Podshow, available from CelticMythPodshow.com. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us a quick email or voice feedback by emailing either Gary, that's G-A-R-Y, or Ruth, R-U-T-H, at CelticMythPodshow.com. You can chat to us in the forums on our website. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hounds, who provided us with the theme music for our show. You heard Haghole at the beginning and are listening to The Skylark now. You can find out more about this foot-stomping band at www.sfhounds.com. And thanks again to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used for some of the incidental music in this podcast. You'll find links to their websites in our show notes.